everyone. Welcome to the Hardcore Finance Podcast with Alex Chizhik and Shimon Lazarov. Today we have a very special guest, Stefan Levera from the Stefan Levera Podcast. Stefan's podcast was actually the first Bitcoin podcast I listened to when I was getting into the space, and I was really, really impressed by the depth of the questions that he was asking his interviewees.
This episode is brought to you by the book Inventing Bitcoin. If you guys haven't gotten into Bitcoin yet, you know that Shimon and I talk about Bitcoin a lot on the podcast. It's a great way to store your wealth. And we really believe it. We're not just shilling it to shill it. It's really going to be the future of money. And to really understand Bitcoin in a simple way, get the book Inventing Bitcoin. It's written by a good friend and longtime Bitcoiner, Jan Pritzker, who's a co-founder of Swan Bitcoin, one of the players in the Bitcoin space. But the book is a fantastic, quick read about what is blockchain, what is Bitcoin, why is Bitcoin so important, and really will give you all the basics. So check out Inventing Bitcoin. You can get on Audible, you can get on Amazon, and really any other places in many different languages that you get your books. So Inventing Bitcoin, check it out.
So, Stefan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show, Shimon and Alex.
Awesome, awesome. So, to give a little bit of background to our listeners, so, you know, both Alex and I are hardcore kind of believers in Bitcoin, and we also like to keep a very open mind to different economic philosophies and models. And we wanted to bring Stefan to the show to discuss what is Austrian economics, because he had a wonderful episode on his podcast just laying it all out. And then we can discuss different scenarios around, you know, how can Austrian economics play out, especially when Bitcoin takes over. So how does that sound, Stefan?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. So where do you want to start?
Yeah. So first, maybe you can tell our listeners, like, what brought you into Austrian economics? Like, when is the first time you were like, oh, maybe Paul Krugman's column in, you know, in the New York Times is not the best way to analyze the economy?
Right. Yeah. So for me, I was in my mid-teens and I was going on IRC, which is Internet Relay Chat. So for the younger listeners, that was kind of like an older chat room thing. And so I was on this Australian politics channel, and this guy kept linking to Mises Daily articles. Now, that's Mises Institute, so Mises.org. And so at that time, it was such a different point of view compared to what I was learning at school in terms of economics and business studies and things like that at school. And over time, that was what got me down the Austrian economics rabbit hole. And so when I was younger, I started with more just reading articles, and then later progressed up into reading the different books in the Austrian tradition, and then also listening to different Austrian economics podcasts and watching talks on YouTube and watching people like Bob Murphy and Tom Woods and Joe Salerno and Guido Hulsman and all of these guys.
Mm-hmm. And then what basically made you think, like, wow, this is a better way to describe the economy and the drivers of growth than the traditional one we hear on the news all the time?
It just made so much more logical sense to me. And it's hard to put my finger on exactly why that was. It just, at that time, it just felt like it made more sense than the explanations I was being given. It was like, it just cohesively and logically flowed so much more nicely that was what appealed to me about it. And that was why, as I went through and tried to study that more and learn more about it, then later I sort of understood a bit more what I was not able to put my finger on as a, you know, mid-teenager. I later learned a little bit more about the actual methodology and how the Austrian school works. And as you get deeper into that, then you start to understand a little bit more around how it's a deductive method. And so it's, you know, you sort of start from certain premises and then you reason forward based on that. And that is where this idea of synthetic a priori truths, like things that you can know to be true, even without having to run an experiment out in the world. So it's not to say that you can't, you know, use some info to help inform you from what's going on in the world, but that's just not how you understand an economic law.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's maybe dive into, like, what is, if you had to give a quick definition of what is Austrian economics and how is it different than Keynesian economics?
Right. And so the Austrian School of Economics, it's a school of economic thought that derives its name from some of the Austrian founders. So this is people like Karl Menger and other famous practitioners in that space are Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Friedrich Hayek, right? And so in terms of as a school, what makes it different? Essentially, it is that praxeological method that we were talking about, that deductive method. And so in practice, what does the school end up emphasizing? It talks about things like things from a bottom-up perspective, the idea of things, you know, having a spontaneous organizing power of the way that people interact and of prices and how in some way prices can convey information and they mean something, that it's not just like a arbitrary number. It's that this is in some sense conveying information through the economy in a way. And that's kind of like, that's a very Hayekian, Friedrich Hayek way of thinking, is this idea of prices being conveyed as information. So essentially the school is more free market, and generally people who are fans of Austrian economics, they tend to be in favor of either having a very small government or having no government and having more privately provided services and privately provided businesses that do those different roles.
Yeah, so I can tell you that for me, what really was enlightening is, first of all, both Alex and I were born in communist countries. I moved to Israel when I was 7 years old in 1990, and seeing that just central planning does not work, like literally the standard of living that the central planners were able to deliver to their population was much, much lower than the standard of living that free markets were able to deliver. That was like the first eye-opening thing. But then the second big eye-opener to me was just thinking of this whole idea of like, I don't remember who wrote it, but the idea is like, does savings and capital accumulation drive higher quality of life? So like higher productivity and more goods and services produced, or does consumption drive higher productivity and better quality of life? And it just intuitively made sense that, like, you know, let's say you said to people, you know, you're fishing, you can spend some of your time to build better fishing rods versus to say, here's some stimulus for you to like fish more with your current fishing rods. Like the better fishing rods will deliver a higher quality of life over time. That was the moment for me. I don't know, Alex, if you want to chime in on like when's the first time you kind of thought, hey, maybe what they're telling us on MSNBC and the New York Times is maybe not the best way of looking at economics.
Yeah, I think it's a hard question. I don't think there's necessarily one time, although it's been, you know, and just recently looking at what's going on with our monetary supply, with the printing of the money, with the, you know, not thinking through unintended consequences. And I'll let me come back to this answer in a second, because I want to kind of explain the way I see this, right? So the economic policy of one country is very much tied to their governmental policy, which is why, Stefan, I think you said, you know, people of the Austrian school of thought tend to favor a smaller government, right? And I think where I always push myself in thinking through the different scenarios or the different economic models is to think about the role of the government, right? Ultimately, if we agree, or once you have a set of people, I think, that agree on what the government should or should not do, you're half of the way there, then it's how do they execute that? And that's a lot of it is the economic policy for me. So for example, allocating negative externalities, right? Should the government do that or not? Like if you have a plant that's spewing pollution into the river and people are drinking that water and dying, right? There's one school that says the market will take care of itself. The other school says the government should step in and, you know, create regulation around it or some sort of border so the company can't do this. So once we agree on that, that's really where, then it's, you know, wherever you are in the spectrum, then it's like a slippery slope either way, right? And that's for me what's really interesting in terms of thinking about like the way we structure our economic system to incentivize different behaviors or not, or leave it alone, is what's the role the ultimate role of the government? Is it to defend, to protect, to allocate externalities? What is it? Then I think we can, that's how I at least do my thought process. I don't know if this is what you guys do.
Yeah, I see. So I think the way, the way some libertarians would characterize that as well is they might, and now maybe some of this is a little bit more of a political question, but they might characterize it more in a sense of freedom from and freedom to, right? So they might say you have freedom from somebody, you know, hitting you or stealing your stuff. That's, you know, the real freedom, but you shouldn't have freedom to do things if that necessitates you having a claim on somebody else or on somebody else's property. And so I think even bringing it back to the economics point, sometimes you have to bring it back to that, that Robinson Crusoe on the island. Let's say there's two people there and, you know, one guy's a doctor and the other guy's not. And if one guy, the guy's not a doctor, is saying, oh, look, see, I have a right to healthcare. So therefore, well, someone's got to provide that. So does that mean this guy has a right to the other guy's services as a doctor? Well, that's a complicated question. And I think most libertarians would say, well, no, you don't have that right. You can ask him, you can voluntarily, you can pay them, but you can't just sort of, you know, force them to. And so I think that maybe that's a little bit more of a political question, but the economic aspect of it, I think you, if you bring it down to what's going on at the individual level, then you get a bit more of a clearer picture on what's going on and whether, you know, capital accumulation is what helps the economy grow and people be more productive. And I guess I really liked that. Shimon, I liked your example earlier with the, you know, catching fish, right? So as an example, if you're, you know, in this kind of Robinson Crusoe example on the island and you think, oh, I just want to catch fish just with my bare hands, you know, like screw whatever, screw all that other stuff. I'm just going to get out there and into the water and just catch them with my bare hands. Well, you know, at some point you're going to realize, hang on, that's not the most effective way to do this. I need something that's more efficient. And now we're starting into, okay, well, I'm going to start saving some in order that I can make a fishing rod and be more efficient with catching my fish, blah, blah, blah. And that is kind of an illustrative example that a lot of Austrian economists use when they're talking about, you know, capital accumulation, what's the impact on society, and how does that improve everyone's living standards?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, so Alex and I went to a very, very Keynesian school. It's probably the most Keynesian kind of top school because it's Northwestern University, which is like in Chicago.
Okay.
And they always had a rivalry between the Chicago School of Economics, which were monetarist, yep, and like the Kellogg, which was like super, super like pro money printing. I remember the professor literally saying like, look, what will happen if you drop money from a helicopter on a town, right? And like just some ridiculous things, right? He was like showing how countries that abandoned the gold standard before other countries had like more growth. And that's kind of stupid because like, is that a cause or is that an effect, right? It's like you never know like what happened there. And that brings us like to the, what I really love also about praxeology is that in macroeconomics, you can't really run experiments. Because like many times a policy that's adopted by a government, it's not like they could like split the country in half and like half the country gets the printed money, the other
yeah,
half, right? You can't really control for that. So, but again, for me, the main kind of thought was like, okay, if you can promote savings and then people invest the money that they save and then companies can use this invested money, you know, to build better machines, that would lead to more production and to a drop in the prices. Now, the counter argument to that, as taught to us in school, was like, look, I mean, there's the negative externalities that Alex mentioned, but that I don't think it's a huge thing because like, you know, giving welfare is not like a negative externality. I mean, we could debate that. But like the counter example was like, no, look, the government has to do things because people think very short term. Right. So if you give someone money, they will like spend it on like immediate things. But if you give the government, if you give the same money to the government, they can plan kind of long term. They can invest in things that maybe companies wouldn't invest in. Right. Like, for example, some people claim investing in education is something that brings you a lot of dividends and like higher productivity and then more taxes collected. But like companies wouldn't do that. Like they wouldn't just take people from the slums and give them like education for free. Although actually some companies do that and they're able to like generate like 12% return to their shareholders and still educate people in India, but that's like a separate thing. So how would you counter that argument that basically says, look, the government can think longer term And that's why we should let it control the money supply and let it print money and give it to some people.
So I think the easy way to think of that is, who is the owner of the thing that we're talking about? And in the case of a private owner of some land, they really do have a long-term incentive to care about it, because they know they will either have this for their own lifetime, and maybe 40, 50 years later, they might still enjoy the fruits of that, or they will be able to pass it on down to their heirs. Now, contrast this with the government. When you, as a politician, your incentive is to, number one, get it elected, and number two, get re-elected. So really, you're much more playing a short-term political cycle game. Now, I guess the other part of this is that there's also bureaucrats as well. So it's not just politicians, but there's the executive kind of branch. And there's, so, I mean, there's the different branches of government. There's legislative, like the politicians, and then there's the executive, who, you know, a whole bunch of other arms of the government and bureaucracy. And some of those people, maybe you could arguably say, yeah, they might try to think about the long term, but they've also got their own perverse incentive too, because in many ways they have an incentive to waste money and keep wasting money, because for them as individuals, what makes sense is to grow their own department. They want to have a lot of staff working under them. They want to have a big budget, because that makes them look good. And that is how you play that game of power and you rise the ranks, because you have a big department and blah, 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 right? So it's kind of a really perverse thing. So the way I see it is, when we're talking about why we think free markets and capitalism is better, we're not saying it's perfect. We're just saying it's better. It's just saying it's less bad than if you were to give all that power to the government. Because in reality, what often happens with the government is that they will end up wasting a lot of money in bureaucracy, or they will not have an appropriate sense of like relative values. And so as an example, because that government, you know, bureaucracy, the head of that government bureaucracy can in effect control other people's land, but they haven't had to pay for that, because the enforcement cost of doing all this stuff is pushed off onto the guns of the government and the police and the, all these other, you know, the military of the government. They are not really paying a true market price for the control that they exert over these different resources. And so this kind of comes as well, bringing it back even to the problems of socialism and so on. That is one of the key problems, is that there is no market in the in the producer goods. So it's not just, you know, we're not just talking about consumer goods here. We're talking about, you know, tractors and, you know, computers and other things that are used to produce. And because there's no market, or not a true free market in terms of the pricing for those, then the bureaucrat will be at a massive disadvantage relative to a free market entrepreneur operating in a free market system, because they are getting a proper profit and loss price signal. So I think that's probably the key point. If I had to summarize the key point, it's that government does not face a profit and loss test, but the individual operating in a voluntary private, you know, free market does face a profit and loss test. So that in essence sends a signal to that entrepreneur, hey, you're making great profits, you're doing a great job, keep using the resources in this way. Whereas the government is not getting that feedback. They just have a very, very light sense of feedback in that kind of ballot box every 3 or 4 years. But that's really a very bad way to express the preferences of the consumers, compared to consumers who are directly paying for or buying and selling the production goods that were required to make those goods and services.
So you brought up a lot of points that I do want to say that, look, we're for sure, I think most of our listeners aren't for socialism. I think Shimon and I aren't.
Of course.
We're very far from that, right? I mean, we saw it, just like you said, it doesn't work. I think though, this is where I was kind of going with the government as leading. They, let's say at one thing the government does for the economy, they install a central bank, or they don't, or they allow a money printing policy that's based on fiat, or they dictate that the, you know, the economy has to be backed by gold, let's say, right? Which is what we had before. So in that case, there's a couple elements there, right? Does the government, I think element one, does the government economically deserve to pick winners and choosers and losers, excuse me, by saying, hey, you know, the wages here should be X, right? Or we're going to print money to help with student loans or whatever it is, right? To inject capital in different industries. And then two is, you said something very early on that was very powerful. I want to come back to, you said in an Austrian school, pricing has, it basically prices contain information, right? And I want to push that as well, because I think in a Keynesian school, prices contain information too, but they contain additional information about how much the government is willing to or not to pick those winners and losers. So for example, if the government's going to inflate money in a certain sector, there's a price that the consumer chooses, right? Hey, there's a bunch of apples. I'm going to pick this apple for $1 instead of this one for $1.10 because of the same thing. But if the government says these apples are whatever, and maybe it's not the best example, but whatever, organic and so on, and we're going to make it really cheap to produce these apples, so those prices rise, they essentially are picking, or the prices fall, they're picking winners and choosers. So I think pricing has information contained in it. It's just how much information from the government is there. Maybe we should start about, do you believe the government has any role in picking winners and losers in any industry?
In the ideal case, no. I believe I'm in the anarcho-capitalist camp, so I believe everything should just be done fully in a free market. Now, do I think that'll happen in my lifetime? Probably not. But in the ideal case, yes, I think that would be a fully free market, fully voluntary, you know, society is, I guess, the what we're shooting for in that sense. Now, I obviously recognize we're nowhere near that in the current world today. So I see it more like anything that I can do to help push it in the direction of less government, that's a win from my perspective. So if there's less taxes, less regulation, I'll take that, right? I'll take that every day of the week. So that's kind of how I would broadly answer that point. And I think to the point around conveying information, I think the very crucial distinction that has to be drawn here is the ownership question. Because if you as an individual are choosing to give up $10 to buy this, you know, this, whatever, these apples, that is very different from the government taxing people and then spending other people's $10 on those apples, because they have not foregone, you know, that bureaucrat is not foregoing his own $10. He's just foregoing $10 of production or of consumption that could have otherwise been done by people out in the private sector. Does that make sense?
No, for sure. So basically the premise is that bureaucrats, which, you know, I happen to agree for slightly other reasons, are not able to efficiently allocate money, be it because they're not incentivized to. And I think what's implicit there is that they're mismanaging essentially to grow their fiefdoms, right? Which is, you said a little bit ago, rather than create this bridge between short-term incentives and long-term incentives that Shimon alluded to, or that's theoretically the benefit of having a centralized kind of more power in the central government.
Yeah. So the way I see it is like government. And here's the thing, I don't want to come off too kind of slack or harsh or whatever, because in some sense, it's like a don't hate the player, hate the game, right? So I think it may well be true that many people in the government, they are genuinely trying to do a good job. They're genuinely trying to use the public resources for good. But the problem is the structure that they exist under. It's that the overarching structure just cannot be efficient. It cannot be productive relative to if we had a fully free market, that they just simply end up having a very bureaucratic style of doing things. And Mises wrote, funnily enough, he's written a book called Bureaucracy, and he's talking about some of these examples of how it's about the underlying structure of the thing. It's not to say that, oh, people in the government are, you know, evil people. It's just that because of the structure that they are in, the incentives and all of this, that is why they will make a subpar outcome relative to if you had simply had kind of the basic, you know, private property rights, respect for people's own choices in the free market. That's the sense in which I mean that.
Yeah. And the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that for the first time, right, we have an alternative that is tested in the market. And that's like a very beautiful thing because like all the experiments until now have been like before and after experiments, right? And so something changes. Like, for example, one of the very vivid things that I remember is like, so in Israel, they basically opened up the market. So it was a kind of socialist system until the 80s. And then the government went bankrupt, like almost went bankrupt. So they were about to default on all their debt. And then I believe it was like Nixon. I don't remember if Nixon or Reagan, but they basically said, look, we'll give you assurances. We'll cover your debt, but you have to completely open up, completely become capitalists, mm-hmm. remove all of the like tariffs. They had like crazy tariffs, like 200% tariff on anything that's not manufactured in Israel. And so lots of people were working like in unproductive like industries. And so it forced Israel to like lay off all of the people that, you know, were working in like textile factories, which like it's much better to buy textile from China. And like instead, the crazy thing is there was a short-term pain. They had to like remove like four zeros from the currency. But very quickly, everybody went back to full employment. And then the economy started really, really booming. Like it's crazy. Israel now, you know, it's a very kind of a successful economy. But like people forget how it was in the 80s. But even this was a before and after, right? So then people could say, no, there were other factors like the high-tech boom that happened in Israel. That's what's driving the growth. And like we could have kept all the union jobs. We could have kept all the textile factories. And it's the high-tech that brought all the prosperity, and you can never prove it. But now with Bitcoin, we actually have an alternative. And I'm actually working on a blog post that examines, I want to call it Bitcoin, the privatization of money. Why governments will let Bitcoin thrive and not ban it. And my thesis there is basically like governments have privatized many things, like all of the Soviet bloc of the ex-USSR. You had government control over something, like you had a cement factory that was controlled by the government, right? All the people there working there were government employees. You couldn't fire them. And then one day the government says, look, we'll auction it off. And then they end up making more tax revenue from like taxing capital gains on that private enterprise than they were making profit when they were operating the thing. So my thesis is that Bitcoin is just like the privatization of money. And like eventually governments will just make the productivity increase because of Bitcoin will be so much higher that the taxes that the government could collect would more than make up for the fact that they're kind of not going to influence the monetary policy of Bitcoin. Do you guys have any thoughts of that? I know I've spoken to Alex a little bit about it.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting idea because certainly there are, if you ask people, you will see responses spanning the gamut, right? There'll be some people who say, no, government will never allow Bitcoin. There are other, you know, I think it's fair to say right now, it's too small for it to matter right now. Like right now, Bitcoin's total market is just under $700 billion in USD terms, which is tiny in the global scheme. But let's say it gets bigger. Let's say it gets to 10 trillion, 20, 30 trillion. Okay, then it's going to start having some level of more significance. And I think you're very right to point out that governments still exist in a competitive, environment with other countries. And so those governments that are more supportive of this as a technology can reap the benefit of letting people coordinate their production in a better way. And so I think it's like a funny thing where they, in some, you know, I guess you could argue theoretically, oh, if they were really authoritarian and they tried to ban it or regulate it to death, maybe that would be better in their own interest. But the practical realities of that are just too difficult because they would have to coordinate across all of the world. It would just be too difficult. And in practice, they would see, you know, some governments would just be more supportive of it. And then people would flock to those jurisdictions. And then those jurisdictions would do really well. It's almost like the opposite of a wealth tax, because some countries do wealth tax and then they basically see a massive, massive outgoing or just a, you know, migration of people who are leaving, like especially rich people and businessmen and so on, who don't want to pay such a ridiculously high level of taxes. So I think I basically agree with you on that idea that I think all said and done, we might see some countries try it, but on the whole, I don't think it's going to get banned and regulated out of existence. It's too powerful and too useful as a technology to be fully for it to go that way.
I think in addition to what you're saying, and I completely agree with your points, is maybe before when it was very young, very small, and if it was actually true that it was used mostly by criminals, maybe. But this is how all innovation bubbles up, right? So it's small. This is why it's actually good to have open competition, right? Because innovation thrives in these openly competitive environments. Startups come up from out of there. This is where the kind of free market allows winners to actually rise up through the grind, through the ash, but then they become diamonds, if you will. But, you know, it was small. Now that it's big and now that it's accepted and now that it just makes so much sense to, hey, we don't need to wait 4 days for the escrow to close or for the funds to settle. It can happen in, you know, seconds or whatever, minutes until you get confirmations on the chain. It just doesn't make sense to do it the old way. And once you're there, and this is a wave of that's coming, I completely agree with you that there's no incentive not only to shut it down, even though it's small, even if it gets big and fully mainstream, all the innovation, all the new jobs, this whole new industry is going to be born on top of this. So if you shut it down, you increase emigration away from your country, stop immigrating the best minds, kill a prospering or budding industry of the future. It makes, like, I think from a government's perspective, if they stop and think, and I actually think the U.S. doesn't do such a bad job of doing this. We're very crypto forward. If you look at some of the other countries in Europe, especially, you're killing your future tax revenue stream. You're killing your future. You're not investing in R&D. Accepting crypto is literally, or Bitcoin or all of it, is really literally investing in the R&D of your country for the future to create an environment where the best people come, which has the highest revenues, which has the most wealth, which creates more taxes. And in a government that cares about taxes, it's a virtuous cycle. So, you know, I think I agree with Shimon here that I think they would want to privatize it and just reap the rewards of the system that the petri dish they created that thrives, where innovation thrives, right? Like, look at India. If they actually pass the ban of cryptocurrencies, we were talking with Shimon about this the other day, their whole boom has been built on top of IT outsourcing and their tech industry. That tech industry is going away. The whole outsourcing is going away. If in 5 years, half the world needs to understand blockchains and they banned it, you know, if DeFi comes, all of this, these promises actually come of the ban and knowledge of playing in the space, they're screwed. They're really, really screwed.
Yeah, I think they are just essentially going to shoot themselves in the foot because this is a game of musical chairs and you want to accumulate Bitcoin now because before it goes up as well. So I think in some sense, I think if you're thinking longer term, you want to encourage your people to have Bitcoin and to use it because longer term, as the price runs up, I mean, it's one of those things where if you're a small or medium-sized nation or in terms of wealth, you could become a powerful nation, a wealthy nation, if you get into Bitcoin early. Now, of course, there are a lot of governments that don't think long term. And so I'm sure we will see some that try to ban Bitcoin and try to stop it and all this stuff. But the reality is it's not going to be stopped at a global level because it's, you know, they're just going to be playing a game of global whack-a-mole and it's just never, you know, they're just not going to be able to stop it. So I think the better approach is essentially to ride this wave rather than be crushed by it.
Cool. Okay, guys. So now I want to play extreme devil's advocate to the one question I have about Keynesianism that actually made me think that it might be a good idea. Okay. So the big thing about money printing, let's imagine that now the government comes and says, we're going to print a shit ton of money, keep interest rates at zero forever, right? And we'll just keep printing money, giving universal basic income to people, and then just like whatever, like this is our policy. Now, the Jeff Booth has a very interesting point in his book about deflation, right? And he says, look, there's technological deflation that makes things supposedly go like cheaper, let's say by 8% every year. Yeah. And then we can inflate the money by like 10%. And then you get like the difference between 10% and 8% is 2%. That's the CPI that you see. Now, what's wrong? And I asked him actually, like, what do you think is wrong with this? Like, why couldn't this continue forever? And he's like, look, it creates a really big inequality, right? So like the people who own the hard assets, they benefit from the printed money. The people who don't own the hard assets will just like be living off the universal basic income. Now, the one argument against this that I could think of is, look, everything is created by energy, right? And technology takes energy and makes it into goods and services. So what if this technological deflation happens so fast that this balancing act actually works? So basically, if the prices go cheaper than the rate of money printing, the universal basic income will just buy you more and more stuff every year. And then basically you can just do this forever, print money forever, keep interest rates at zero, and the rich will get very rich, but the poor will get like a better and better like quality of life. And actually, people who defend Keynesianism, one of the biggest defenses is that it has been able to deliver, you know, a high standard of living for people. And you just look at countries that print money, and life is not really bad there. Now, of course, you can never prove what would have been the standard of living without the money printing. Like, people like us probably believe that the standard of living would be even better, right? But if we believe that energy is abundant, and you know, now we have solar energy, we can have nuclear energy, so in a sense, we have infinite energy. What is the hole in this argument of just like, let's print money forever, keep interest rates at zero? The other thing I'll mention is like, the Austrian school talks about malinvestments. Yes. Because basically it says like, you know, you pay people to do something. Like if we think of the Green New Deal, and Alex and I had an episode on this. Green New Deal, let's print a bunch of money and give it to people to retrofit windows, right? To make buildings more energy efficient. So in one hand,
the only thing of the Green New Deal, like, but you're taking an extreme example.
I'm just giving an extreme example, right? Where we say, look, this is a bad idea because like people are doing productive things. It will force them to do like less productive things. But what if robots were the ones retrofitting the windows? What if we could say like, look, let's print a bunch of money, build a bunch of robots, and then they'll retrofit the windows and energy drives the robots. And so people can just keep doing what they're doing. So what is your guys' argument against this steel man?
Gotcha.
And
yeah.
By the way, the other premise, just before Stefan answers, the other premise is they have very cheap, almost unlimited energy. Like if everyone has nuclear,
yeah,
and the energy is the marginal cost of energy, right? Not total, but marginal cost of energy is fairly cheap. So you're not worried about any kind of source of energy as an input.
Yeah. Okay. So let me try to answer. I mean, there's a lot in there. So let me just try to give you some high level thoughts on each of those things. So energy wise, I think in practice, what matters is getting it to where it's needed, right? So it's not just the production of energy, but it's about getting it to where it's needed and doing that in practical terms. That's where some of the costs can come in. And in practice, a lot of governments around the world are doing all this crazy kind of wind and solar renewable stuff, when in practice, I think we're going to be on coal and mostly natural gas for a long time to come, just simply because a lot of other energy sources are not as practical and viable at the, like, when you really talk about scaling, right? But I guess that's only one part of this, right? So the broader point, I think I should just explain around malinvestment, which is, so the concept of malinvestment is basically saying that entrepreneurs are being given the wrong signal thanks to the availability, or the cheap availability, or I should say the artificially cheap availability of credit. And so because of government manipulating with the money and central banking and all of these monetary interventions, entrepreneurs are being, what that does is it causes a problem in the capital structure of society. So essentially prices and the interest rate help coordinate those stages of production, right? So if you need to, whatever, make the truck so that you can deliver the apples to the store, to that you can buy the apples, like whatever, right? The stages in that process, it matters the kind of relative prices and the interest rate to help coordinate all of that. So what happens when you change that interest rate, as Keynesians do, then they are essentially driving this malinvestment. And that is like, as, and to the point you were saying, Shimon, it's hard to point to that in practice because it's about what could have been. It's an unseen, right? We could have been so much more productive, right? Now, let me bring it kind of full circle back to your question, Shimon, which was around, you know, okay, what happens if we just keep going on this technological deflation or growth deflation, as Dr. Joe Salerno might call it? What if we just keep having that going on at the same time as fiat inflation, which is the government and that associated system enabled by fractional reserve banking and enabled by government to continue the money printing? Well, I'll tell you what, I think that's actually the likely outcome, right? But that's not what would be most productive. What would be most productive is we return to, you know, is the government removes all monetary intervention, everyone chooses whatever money they want, whether that's Bitcoin or gold or whatever, and then, you know, there would be that initial, as you mentioned, kind of like a short-term pain for long-term gain, but we know that that's obviously not going to happen anytime soon, but hypothetically, like, that would be more productive. And I think we can sort of spell out the logical chain of reasoning as to why that would be, because again, it comes back to those same problems around ownership, coordination, you know, structure of the economy, all of those points that we'd sort of have to weave together to understand what's going on here. But in terms of what is actually a likely outcome, yes, I actually do think it's likely that the government will keep on printing money because it's a political question. It's not just an economic question here. And because so many people are, you know, feeling that there's this kind of, they've been, I guess, put into this system where many of them feel like they don't have a hope or they don't have a chance. There's kind of increasing calls for UBI and for socialism and blah, blah, blah. So I think it's likely that they keep doing that. It's just, now, the thing is that people who realize and wake up to Bitcoin being available now, they'll buy Bitcoin. And so there's kind of these parallel things going on at the same time. So I think governments of the world will try to, they've painted themselves into a corner. And so now they're kind of stuck. They can't raise interest rates. So they're going to have to just keep the inflation going and they're going to try to eke it out for as long as possible, right? They're just going to kick the can as much as they can. But on the parallel side, you got all these people who can just buy Bitcoin and escape that way. So that's kind of the what I see playing out over the next, call it 10, 15 years.
So I totally agree with you, by the way, about the governments. We're kicking the can. And at some point, all this is going to come due. And it'll be interesting when maybe there'll be a reckoning when the US cuts, you know, 3 zeros off of our currency, like a lot of the at least ex-Soviet bloc countries did, and then what the hell is going to happen to our economy. But let me go back a couple steps here. Yep. You mentioned something. You said, you know, this, and Shimon, you kind of said the same thing. And this is where I'll disagree with you guys. This is where the Austrian school breaks down for me. And I agree with it like 75%, but this last 25, I don't know which way I'm going to go. Let me explain to you.
Sure.
What it is. It's like the other way would have been better. And even if we can, well, Bitcoin is maybe the first time we can truly see a parallel system to some extent, because it's always going to be tied into the existing fiat system. They're going to coexist, or at least it'll be, I think, a very long time, like hundreds of years until we move fully onto like all Bitcoin. But ultimately, a hardcore libertarian would say that every person or family, let's call it, are fending for themselves. You can create alliances, right? You can do whatever, but that's kind of your free will, right? I want to go and do this. I want to fend for myself. Sure. Like, I want to live in a neighborhood with a volunteer fire department and not pay insurance. If my house burns down or someone else's who hasn't paid, let it burn down, right? That's ultimately the purest, if you will, form of kind of libertarianism, Austrian economics. So here's where kind of why I struggle with this is, at what point do we have a moral, the 3 points, we have a moral obligation to care for our neighbors? That point number one. Point number two is, if we do, what is it and how much is it worth? Because it has to have some sort of utility associated to it. And the utility comes from this pure system. It's like a tax on that pure system. And three is, if we don't do it, the pain of, you said, short-term pain for long-term gain, the pain of some people through sometimes death, right? That all that pain, is that pain going to be bigger or smaller than the little bit of pain that everyone else is going to feel, but everyone's going to feel it together. That's ultimately to me what is the difference between the two schools. And I don't know morally how to value how much I should contribute to help my fellow man, so to speak. And what is that worth as a tax on the system?
Right, so let me jump in here. One second. I want to say something because I feel very strongly about this. And then Stefan, you can say
sure. too.
Alex, everything that you said could be done voluntarily. And there's examples, right? So the ultra-Orthodox people in Israel and sometimes in the US, they have their own parallel system. They don't buy health insurance. They don't pay taxes because they don't make money or whatever. And then they self-insure as a community, right? So like, for example, you ask how much, you have tithing in Christianity, right? You give some percent of your income to the community, and then someone in the community distributes in the community. Now, when you think about it, if we had a free market, you look at your neighboring city that has ultra-Orthodox people, and you look at your city where it's anarchy and every man for themselves and nobody's tithing.
But it's not in the city, Shimon. I'm talking about like if your neighbor, volunteer fire department, their house is burning down, do you say, okay, fine, I paid for the insurance, use it, or I paid for the fire department, use it, right? Let's go very micro here. Because
like an example of fire, just because like, yes, there are some things where there can be contagion, like fire. Okay, maybe the government should do that. But welfare?
But now we're drawing, but exactly, that's my whole point. Yes, now we're drawing a line on the scale.
My line, and I would love to hear Stefan's thoughts, my line is like whatever can be done voluntarily, right? I'm for that. Whatever cannot be done voluntarily, yeah, like an army. Like, seriously, I don't think that the libertarian idea of like hiring a private army could work. But that's a much smaller government than we currently have.
But nobody's arguing against a smaller government or not. We're arguing where this line is.
I'm arguing against welfare and education and healthcare.
So look, guys, So I understand that even in the libertarian world, there are constant debates amongst between minarchist people and anarcho-capitalist people and blah, 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 and exactly what should be done by the government. It is ultimately a moral, you know, it's kind of like more like a moral question and a philosophical question than an economic one. But what I can offer, though, is I could say, look, ultimately, if you want society to be more productive, and if we know that it will just be so much more productive by being more capitalist, then what tends to happen is that people who are more, you know, who are poorer or more in some other way, they tend to just get looked after because we've seen such massive, massive productivity benefits to the upside for the rest of society. Also, we should note, historically, there was such a thing as a private welfare state. So there's a really good book on this. It's called From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State by David T. Beto. And in that book, he talks about how there were all these societies. Some of them were religious based and some of them were just, you know, community and, you know, whatever. And these were ways that people would chip into their community and help out the people who were less fortunate. And so I think that's also another way that in practice, really, most, like if we did live in a fully free market society, what you would see is like richer people who just chip in to help out those people in kind of the bottom 5 or 10% of society in the wealth wise, that they can still get basic services, right? And that's kind of how I think the anarcho-capitalist kind of world might look like. But of course, I don't know if we're going to get there in my lifetime, right? So I think in practice, what we get before then is this idea of something closer to free private cities. Now, one of my episodes I did with Titus Gable, we spoke about this idea, and it was kind of like a privately run city. And so it was a similar kind of idea where they were saying, okay, like because they're cutting out so much of the other stuff, you can basically the cost of living there would be so much cheaper. And then there might be an agreement, okay, everyone just chips in to look after the people who can't quite afford to look after themselves, or for whatever reason, if they have some kind of disability or, you know, things like that where they can't look after themselves, then fine. You pay for that only. But the net benefit is just that, you know, the government is so, so much smaller that, you know, it's just a net benefit for everyone.
By the way, I love this concept of private cities, essentially, because I think out of all the theses about Bitcoin, it's an investment, it's gold. I think this point shouldn't be forgotten. To me, it's the most important one. And Shimon, you and I talk about this a lot. To your credit, this is one of the biggest things you bring up, but the custody piece. you can, with in the world of Bitcoin, you don't need to worry mostly about a government telling you, no, you can't take your belongings out. And so what Bitcoin is going to do, I think, in the long run, will create an environment where when first countries, then country states, then cities are going to start competing globally for the best place to live. And if you believe that, hey, we should live in a kumbaya world, you go to the kumbaya city, right? If you want to believe in hardcore anarcho-capitalism, you go to the anarcho-capitalism city. And each city will resemble its culture definitionally and their values definitionally. And then we'll be able to see, and people will be able to choose. And literally the best system will win out in practice without a lot of interference by politicians. Because definitionally, you know, that will win out. And that's what Bitcoin gives us, right? It's the ability to choose where you want to live and where you want to dedicate your energy to.
Exactly. And some refer to this as citadels.
I love it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think, again, that the super exciting thing is that, you know, with libertarians, the fact that we created a new technology and, you know, the printing press was such a technology. There were many. The internet was such a technology. And I feel that, like, the Bitcoin is just like, it's amazing that you have this monetary network. I mean, I have a fun fact, which is, like, some people were able to protect their wealth in Bolshevik Russia. I know this from Bulgaria, but I bet it was the same in Russia. What happened is if you had a bunch of gold, like in London, when the Bolsheviks came, all you had to do is like you get to the top like official that has a relative in London, and you have a relative in London, and you say, look, if you treat me well, I will pay you every month. Like my relative will pay your relative right in London. And then that way you kind of go around capital controls and like everybody benefits, like the official benefits from the bribe, the guy benefits from better treatment. And in a sense, when you think of like, for example, what Jack Mallers did now with the Zap thing where Strike, you can basically transfer Strike. Yeah. So like between two countries, you can send one currency, goes to the other country, it becomes another currency instantly and for free. And that's amazing. And that only exists because of this network that we've created. So I just think it's super, super exciting. We're going to have many, many tests to the libertarian ideals now in the real world. And yeah, people congregate around what works. So yeah, this was super fascinating. Stefan, can you tell our listeners where can they find about you and what you're up to these days?
Yeah, so listeners can find me at stefanlevera.com or they can find me on the podcatcher applications. I host one of the world's leading Bitcoin and Austrian economics shows. It's a great way for people to learn about Bitcoin. So definitely go and check that out.
Yeah, I really, really recommend Stefan Levera's podcast. It's literally one of the best ones out there. Well, thank you so much, guys. This was a true pleasure.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, guys, for having me on the show. I enjoyed chatting with you.